Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, the debate over student loan debt is heating up. Temple professor Sarah Goldrick-Robb will weigh in, and we'll take your calls and comments as well. Also, we meet the teenage genealogy expert who's helping police departments crack cold cases. Eric Schubert will join us later this hour. But first, the pandemic has been front and center for Philadelphia City Council this month as council members considered and approved key legislation aimed at providing relief to industries hardest hit by COVID-19, including the hospitality and tourism sectors and restaurants. On Thursday, a series of bills called the Black Workers Matter Economic Recovery Package won unanimous support. It would provide security, job security, to thousands of workers in Philly's tourism and hospitality industries, many of whom are of color. And earlier this month, council passed a bill to give independent restaurants a six-month reprieve from eviction. Also, pandemic aside, there's a new development construction tax to talk about and a delay in the reduction of the city's tax abatement. City Council President Daryl Clark joins us once again to discuss the recent developments in council. Welcome back to the Roundup, Daryl.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. So, job security of critical importance, of course, as parts of the economy continue to shut down. There are over 10,000 people employed in Philadelphia's hospitality and tourism industries. Thousands of these workers, again, have been laid off. A big question regards what happens when the economy begins to recover and employers begin to rehire. And one bill in question here builds in safeguards for those who were laid off. Tell us about these safeguards and why council members apparently believe them to be critical.
Well, too frequently, when you see layoffs and you see changes of actually ownership, these owners of these companies, they make a determination, well, I'm going to lay people off and I'm going to hire new people back. And more often than not, they hire them back with less benefits, lower pay. And we wanted to make sure that any individual that was currently working at a hotel or some other sort of hospitality industry had a first option to come back at that job. They also needed to be notified about the change in ownership because, as I said earlier, too frequently these changes of ownership tend to be problematic for the workers at these particular locations. So we wanted to make sure that we put protections in. We've seen a lot of instances where people actually were taken advantage of because of the pandemic, but we wanted to protect our individuals in our hospitality industry.
So when we're talking about, you know, new vendors coming in, say at like a Philadelphia International Airport, what sort of vulnerability, you know, in the pandemic is this sector of the hospitality industry facing? Have you gotten a lot of pushback from the hospitality and tourism industries because of this legislation?
Well, initially, people don't like change, but the simple reality is they understand that some of these same individuals who have suffered disparities in terms of opportunities, lower pay, really needed some assistance. So we ultimately got on board. We got the council members on board, and people understood that we really needed to protect these individuals. So the early pushback quickly went away when we laid out the realities of what we needed to do for these people. So we're fine.
Has Mayor Kenney signed off on any of these bills?
Well, he hadn't signed them yet, but he will hopefully very shortly. He has until January the 28th to sign the bills, but we anticipate that he will sign all of the legislation that we passed in our last session and return it to council.
Indoor dining is, as we know, prohibited at this time in Philadelphia, and a bill passed earlier this month would prevent independent smaller restaurants from facing eviction for a period of about 6 months. Many of these establishments right now are on the bubble. Daryl Clark, will this be enough to prevent them from going under?
Well, I'd like to say yes, but the simple reality is it's going to be a challenge for a long, long time. These companies, these restaurants, all these businesses need help from the federal government. The bottom line is they need to pass the Recovery Act as soon as possible. There's only so much we can do locally. Unfortunately, and maybe fortunately, the city of Philadelphia, we cannot print money. We must not deficit spend. So we can only spend the money that we have. But the federal government needs to step up, and they need to step up now. Put the politics aside, pass the Recovery Act bill, get some support to these individual businesses.
So much has happened since we last spoke with you. I think back in the summer, you know, the city is now seeing a post-Thanksgiving spike in coronavirus cases. Restrictions are back in place. There are, you know, worries about stresses on the healthcare system. Although a vaccine is on the way, is imminent. But still, as we enter the new year, what are your primary concerns for the well-being of Philadelphia?
Well, actually, my most significant concern is that people believe because the vaccine is on its way that they're going to relax. They're going to not follow the guidelines that we have established across the country for a long, long time. You know, wear your mask, socially distance, make sure you wash your hands, practice every imaginable recommendation by the CDC and the FDA, because the simple reality is we can get to a place much quicker to get back to somewhere near normal if we practice those guidelines. The vaccines won't be here for a while. Healthcare workers are starting to get them today, but the general population, there's going to be 3, 4, 5, possibly 6 months before you actually get that opportunity. So please continue to practice guidelines.
Are you comfortable getting the vaccine yourself?
I can't wait. This has been a challenge for us all, but, you know, I'll simply have to get in line and wait until it's my turn, but I will get the vaccine. We want to get back to some sense of normalcy. This has been a challenge for the entire world, but we will get through this, and we're asking people be vigilant, be strong, but follow guidelines. We'll get to a point at some point.
And what do you say to those who might be leery about taking the vaccine, particularly in neighborhoods of color who might not have had the best experiences with the healthcare industry?
Well, at the end of the day, you have to make a choice, and it's your choice. And I understand the concerns based on the history of what has happened in this country and other places. But the reality is that the efficacy of these particular vaccines that have basically one has been authorized, second shortly, Moderna will shortly be authorized. We believe that it is safe. There will be individuals that will be taking it early to send the signal. We're prepared to do it in a public way. We think that we need to get our economy back. We need to get our country back to some sense of normalcy. We need to get our families back. So please give every consideration. But at the end of the day, it's your decision to make.
Okay. This past week, City Council approved a residential development impact tax, essentially 1% on new construction, along with a delay in the reduction of the 10-year tax abatement. So first to the impact tax, the construction tax. When would it go into effect? How much money is it expected to generate?
Well, let me start off by saying, traditionally, you know, when you have challenging times, people's inclination is to kind of pull back, get conservative, to contract. But the reality is we believe in an aggressive investment in the city of Philadelphia and in neighborhoods across, in the people. So we're looking at borrowing $400 million that will be funded in terms of the debt service by an impact tax and a change in the tax abatement. Too frequently, neighborhoods across the city of Philadelphia, those quote-unquote formerly choice neighborhoods, have not had the level of investment that we've seen in certain parts of the neighborhood. The city of Philadelphia, along with the government in some respects, has been subsidizing market-rate housing in particular for almost 30 years, and now it's time to shift some of that subsidy to invest in these neighborhoods, to invest in affordable housing, to invest in existing housing, to make sure that people stay in their homes, the most affordable place that one can be in, to invest in our commercial corridors. This will be the single most largest investment in the city of Philadelphia's history as it relates to neighborhood. We anticipate that this will leverage approximately $2.1 billion of investment in our city over the course of 4 to 5 years, creating around 15,000 jobs. So this is something that we must do. Too far, we have not invested in our neighborhoods the way we should do. We think this is the ideal time to do that.
This tax was bitterly opposed by the construction industry when it was considered a couple of years ago. Why did it pass muster now?
Well, people understand the need. The recent pandemic and the social unjust that has been brought before us, magnified in the most significant way, has finally caused people to realize what we've known all along. The disparities in these communities of color have been significant. And people understand it's time to do something, and it's time to have an equitable opportunity across the city of Philadelphia. So we still got some pushback, but once we explain the process, explain the legislation, and explain the benefits associated with the city in general, people got on board. And we're going to do this. We're going to do this in an aggressive way, and we believe genuinely that this is going to help everybody. Too frequently and too long, this particular industry has had a significant level of support. The 2017 tax law changes that was solely for the purpose of enhancing real estate development initiatives for market rate. The tax abatement, 10 years, 100% across the board for 25 years, Keystone Opportunity Zones. All these things have benefited the market rate. Now it's time to allow us to subsidize some of these communities and invest in these neighborhoods across the city.
Well, one of the givebacks here was a pushback, a delay in a reduction in the property tax abatement. And, of course, you know, the real estate industry says the abatement has revitalized the city. Opponents say it takes money from Philly's public schools and encourages gentrification. Are they both right?
Well, the simple reality is that we needed to get the number of votes, and we wanted to make sure that the mayor was on board. So there was a shutdown in authorization for permits for construction for several months during the pandemic. They asked us for an extension. We said, well, if you want an extension, you got to get on board with what we tried to do last year, was to have an impact tax. They got on board in large degree, and the reality is that this 1 year, in terms of delay, will actually be offset because we changed the abatement on the commercial side, and we will realize revenue not only to the city but to the school district of the city of Philadelphia, in addition to which this $400 million of investment in the city will create a significant amount of money also for schools because the sales tax of purchases of goods and services also goes to the schools. So this more than offsets that one-year delay as it relates to the tax abatement. But the general overall commitment to our city, you will see significant levels of opportunity and significant levels of jobs. And the bottom line is investing in these communities of color across the city of Philadelphia, in addition to neighborhoods that had heretofore not had any level of investment, is probably one of the most important things we can do in our political careers.
We've only got about 30 seconds left, but I did want to quickly get to a bill approved by council on ghost guns, homemade guns. They don't have any serial numbers. Therefore, they're almost impossible to trace. What does this bill do?
Well, we're essentially going to prohibit the sale of certain types of material. Basically, what you're allowed to do is get a piece of hardware and allows you to put it together in a way that it can't be traced. It will ultimately end up being a very usable gun. And across the city of Philadelphia and across the country, these ghost guns are something that has been very problematic. I know Councilman Kenyatta Johnson has been pushing on this for a long time. And anything we can do to stem the tide of the proliferation of weapons in the city of Philadelphia, and we're quickly approaching some historic numbers in terms of homicides, we need to do. So this is one more tool in our box to try to stop these homicides in our city.
Yeah, well over 450. Daryl Clark, president of the Philadelphia City Council, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, we'll talk soon. Stay with us as the regional roundup continues. We talk about student loan forgiveness coming right up.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Skyrocketing student loan debt in the U.S. has long been a third rail issue among politicians, but now with a huge growth in pandemic-related unemployment, the call to provide new and significant student loan relief is intensifying. The Trump administration has again extended a reprieve to those who hold such loans. Payments are suspended and interest rates will remain at 0% through the end of January. But as the economic forecast for the first part of 2021 remains bleak, advocates for student loan forgiveness are increasingly looking for action from the incoming Biden administration. President-elect Joe Biden has indicated he supports modest forgiveness of up to $10,000 in debt per borrower. However, opponents are saying paying off student loans will cost billions, perhaps as much as $1 trillion, and taxpayers will end up footing the bill. If you've got questions or comments, here's the number, 888-477-9499. You can send us an email to radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at @WHYY Radio Times. Our guest is Sarah Goldwick Robb, professor of sociology and medicine at Temple University. And welcome back to the show, Sarah. Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us a bit more about how the pandemic has exacerbated the student loan debt crisis.
Well, look, people are having real trouble paying their bills right now, and that's all sorts of people, whether or not they went to college, of course. They're having trouble paying their rent. They're having trouble affording food. There have been a series of job losses. Some people have gotten some additional work during the pandemic and then found that that disappeared. And when money is tight, to be perfectly honest, those student loan payments can be an enormous burden. And they were a burden before the pandemic. And again, thanks to these changing economic conditions that keep getting worse, it's getting harder and harder.
How does student loan debt impact those who have difficulty paying it off? Paint the picture for us, if you would.
Well, it can do a lot of harm. And, you know, a lot of people think this is just an isolated problem. But listen, here in Philadelphia, 1 in 4 adults has student loan debt. So this is not something that's happening to 5 or 10% of people. People with student loan debt are postponing major efforts and events in their lives, including getting married, including having children. People are putting off their repairs on their homes, things that can actually lead to greater crises. You know, not being able to fix that leak in your roof right now as it's raining, as we all know, can then lead to the house being destroyed. You know, the student loan debt adds up, and it basically just becomes another thing that's rolling down the hill towards these families.
Now, last year, a federal report showed that a full third of college students say they don't have enough to eat at times. Guessing, Sarah, that, you know, if a student is food insecure, that student will be more likely to drop out and carry some debt for an incomplete degree. Are you seeing a fair amount of this?
That's right. That's right. So my team has been studying these issues of food and housing insecurity among college students for more than a decade. And you're absolutely right. The student loan debt problem starts well before the student is actually sitting there facing the debt bill. It starts in college when they're not able to actually afford their basic living expenses. And their inability to pay for those things does make it much less likely that they will finish degrees. What most people don't understand is that a lot of the student loan debt today is held by people who have high school degrees but never finished college. So they're in debt with no degree to actually help pay for it, which is why an amount of even, say, $8,000 or $9,000 looks so hard to pay for. They just don't have the additional income that comes with a college degree.
How about the Pell Grant program? It's supposed to cover low-income students working toward undergraduate degrees at public colleges and universities, if I'm correct.
Is this
no longer the case, though?
That's right. Yeah. When we say things like, you know, in your opening, you mentioned some people are saying, well, you know, it's going to cost taxpayers a lot. Well, you know what? Taxpayers actually have been saving a lot of money at students' expense for decades. When we set up the Pell Grant program at the federal level 50 years ago, the Pell Grant program, which again, taxpayers were supposed to fund, was supposed to cover 100%, the full cost of attending any public 2-year or 4-year college in the United States for a low-income person. And why? Because this country could not afford to lose the talent that is possessed by people without wealth. So the thought was, give them the Pell Grant and they will get college degrees. It won't be that poverty kept them from it. But instead of actually fulfilling the promise, the taxpayers of this country, supported by Congress, actually have paid less and less. So that today, the Pell Grant only covers about 1/3 of the cost of attending a public 4-year institution like Temple, and only about 60% of attending an institution like the Community College of Philadelphia. Yeah. As a result, Pell Grant recipients who were not supposed to have to carry $1 of debt 90% of them are now in debt. 90%. So that's a complete failure of public policy on our part.
So let's talk about the power of the Oval Office to help with student loan debt. In 1965, Congress gave the executive branch authority to make decisions regarding relief of such debt, and the federal government has extended a suspension of payments and interest rates through the end of January. What else can an administration do? What is your understanding, Sarah?
My understanding, and this is going to be really, you know, an interesting moment if this happens, but it does appear that executive action can be taken to cancel debt. The question is really going to be what the Biden-Harris administration's appetite for that cancellation will be. And there is a political calculus here. Now, there, of course, have always been debates over how much we should spend on X, Y, or Z. But this issue has become additionally complicated. Because now it's not just about canceling debt for the individual to owe the debt. It's also about two other really big issues. One, economic stimulus, which I think we all would benefit from right now. We all understand we need more money pouring into our economy to try to keep businesses open, to try to keep people employed. And there are good projections that canceling student loan debt would be an economic stimulus, in other words, for people who don't even have the debt. The second thing is that it would do real good in terms of the racial wealth gap. And that's something Philadelphia knows a lot about. One major reason that this city struggles is that we cannot all equally participate in the city, and that Black and brown communities throughout this city are left out of many opportunities, in part because they have far less wealth. Canceling student loan debt would do more good for those folks.
So Joe Biden, President-elect mm-hmm. Joe Biden, the figure that's been bandied about in association with Mr. Biden would be $10,000. Democratic U.S. Senator Chuck Schumer is proposing $50,000 in student loan forgiveness, obviously a lot more money. Where do you land in this debate as to how much money, if there were student loan forgiveness, how much money should be set aside per student?
You know, my answer is I think we should forgive as much debt as we can actually afford to while also tackling the underlying reasons that we have the debt in the first place. So I want to see resources going to both forgiving debt to make up for past mistakes and resources going to address the fact that community college should be free tuition and that we need meaningful programs to address students' living expenses. Now, what can we actually afford? This is something that the wonks in D.C. are going to have to go in and do the math on. But my strong suspicion is that $10,000 is too low, $50,000 is probably closer to right, including because we will make money from the economic stimulus, right? So what people have to understand is you want to spend money to make money, and therefore it doesn't cost you the same as when you just spend money to throw it away, the way that we do when we spend money on prisons, for example.
All right, let's get to the phones. Jerome in Perkasie is standing by. Welcome to the Regional Roundup, Jerome.
Hi. So as a senior, I would be a proponent for medical bill forgiveness prior to any student loan forgiveness. Students have a whole lifetime to pay back the loan. Seniors who are in medical debt, that seems more like a priority to me, especially like a student maybe from Doylestown who went to University of Wisconsin and went away to school when there were plenty of schools around here, and the tuition credit costs would be much lower to go to a local school, but went away and spent a lot of money and incurred a lot of debt. I think that's kind of wasteful for taxpayers, and medical bill forgiveness would be a higher priority.
Jerome, thanks for the call to the Regional Roundup. Sarah Goldrick-Robb, there's Jerome's sentiment, and then there are also there's a sentiment of those who think, well, there should be a distinction drawn between those who incur debt trying to get an undergraduate degree versus a graduate degree. And I'm not necessarily talking about the work of a physician, but some say canceling graduate school debt, perhaps other degrees, or who knows, would overall help a wealthier segment of the population.
Yeah. So here's the thing, Jerome. We can do both. First of all, everybody has different priorities, and yours are understandable given where you are in life. I'm sure, though, that you would also ask yourself whether you would put that priority for yourself ahead of, for example, pre-K education. They have a whole lifetime ahead of them, too. But we also tell ourselves stories about students we would not want to support, and we do so at the peril of actual facts and data. The vast majority of students who owe debt today do not owe debt because of frivolous choices about choosing to go to a school they just saw on television. Most of them actually went to a local institution. Most of them went to places like your local community college or your local university. And they owe this debt because we have failed to set up a proper financing system. I also want to note, you say they have a lifetime to pay it off. The studies show that over a 20-year period following college, Black graduates still have to pay off about 95% of their debt. It's the white students who 20 years later have actually gotten ahead and paid off most of their debt. So I think that we have to be very, very careful about sticking to the evidence on this one and being sure that we make the right decisions that are equitable decisions too.
All right, continuing with our calls, Ariel in Elkins Park, you are live on the Regional Roundup. Hello, Ariel.
Hello.
So welcome, and what's your question or comment?
My comment, I'm not sure how many people it pertains to, but for a certain number of us with a lot of debt on income-based repayments, getting something like Biden's idea of just $10,000, it won't affect our monthly payments, and it won't affect how long we're going to have to make payments. And as much as I would love for student debt to be forgiven, as much as it would positively affect my everyday life, I would much rather that that $10,000 goes to something like food stamps or something where it will actually make a difference, because just putting a little bit toward it is not going to help.
Well, we appreciate the call. So, Sarah, this goes back to our conversation about food insecurity. Yep. and immediate relief as opposed
sure.
to something long-term.
Yes. So the $10,000 of debt cancellation would immediately cancel all of the debt held by 15 million Americans. And it would also cancel 50% of the debt held by another 9 million Americans. Those 15 and 9 million Americans, the 24 million, are disproportionately Black and brown. I don't think that we can make judgment calls about the extent to which this will not help them. It will. Will there also be some additional people for whom it's not enough? Sure. But again, we can walk and chew gum at the same time. The Biden administration is absolutely going to be making changes to programs, including SNAP, to be sure that people can also get more access to food. We don't have to any longer trap ourselves in an either-or mindset.
So let's get back to an issue you brought up a little bit earlier. If student loans are forgiven, you know, taxpayers pick up the bill, and some who are opposed are saying, look, I didn't go to college. I'm working hard at one, maybe even more blue-collar jobs, just trying to make ends meet. It's really tough for me to understand why my tax dollars should have to pay for somebody else's decision to take out a student loan.
Yeah, so here's the thing. Those blue-collar workers who have those jobs can only have those jobs if our economy is strong. If these people with student debt cannot spend their money on things like buying cars, then people who work to build cars will not have jobs. We all live in a common community and economy together. And I think, unfortunately, we're asking ourselves over and over, who's in the most pain? Who has been cut out of the most opportunities? And focusing only on them. When we live in the wealthiest nation in the entire world and can absolutely afford to address the pain of multiple constituencies.
Some are also concerned, Sarah, that prospective borrowers might say, oh, if loans are canceled, it might happen again. So how, in your opinion, should parameters be drawn when talking about crafting student loan forgiveness?
Well, look, I mean, I think that as we've been discussing, the main parameters are about how much and about who. So there are lots of discussions about an income cap on this. I'm personally not a big fan of income caps, because when you put one in place, what you do is you add a ton of red tape to a program. And I think everyone listening knows what it's like to go through the government's red tape. We can get rid of red tape and save ourselves a fortune, frankly, in the administrative bureaucracy by not putting an income cap. But we can also do things, like you said, to be sure that the debt does not build up again in the future. Unfortunately, we understand how we got here. We understand that we underfunded our commitment to public higher education. We understand that we underfunded Pell Grants. We understand that we said to employers, please hire college graduates, but never said to employers, you need to offer decent jobs to college students so that they can work and go to school and actually get the degrees in the first place. We can tackle all of those issues at the same time that we also remedy some of our past errors by forgiving some of the debt.
Has there been an issue with educating those who are applying for loans? You know, buyer beware. Are applicants given sufficient counseling as to what paying off loans will mean, what their lives might look like years down the road, you know, whether the economy is booming or whether there's a recession?
The evidence is actually no, that those hypotheses that the problems here are due to poor information or bad spending habits of borrowers, all of the available scientific evidence says those things are not true. We have tested with randomized control trials, interventions to provide more information. That, in fact, is not effective. The simple fact is people are taking loans because they need money. You can't afford college without money. In fact, when we give them more loans, they graduate at higher rates, not because loans are good for them, but because you cannot get through school if you cannot pay your rent. We need to give them alternative ways to have money without it creating debt. That's the solution.
So does the student loan system need to be overhauled at all? And if so, what do you think needs fixing?
Yes, it needs to be overhauled. It should not be the centerpiece of anyone's financing system for higher education. And that's for a very simple reason. America does not succeed if people turn away from educational opportunity. That's the main reason we made elementary school free. It's the main reason we made high school free. It's the main reason that we can and must make community college free next, and then eventually the public universities too. We should not place debt between people and educational opportunities because it works against our communities, it works against our health, and it works against our economy.
And quickly, Sarah, as we face a reckoning post-pandemic with this economy, the U.S. economy, is there the money there for these initiatives?
Yes, there absolutely is the money there. I think we've all seen plenty of evidence that money has not exactly been carefully and well spent over the last 4 years. As long as somebody is in there who actually knows what they're doing with regard to budgets, we have plenty of money to go around.
Sarah Goldrick-Robb, such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us once again.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah is professor of sociology and medicine at Temple University and founding director of the Hope Center for College, Community, and Justice. Up next on the Regional Roundup, we speak with Eric Schubert. He's 19 years old. He's got his own business, ES Genealogy, and he's also helping police departments solve cold cases. It's going to be a great conversation. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. This is the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. Detective work has been given an enormous boost in recent years by a technique called investigative genetic genealogy. Practice of identifying suspects and solving cases by using DNA recovered from a crime scene. It's a method which led to the arrest and conviction this year of Joseph DeAngelo, the so-called Golden State Killer, who pleaded guilty to 13 murders and over a dozen instances of sexual assault, crimes which happened in the 1970s and 80s. Most cold cases are not as sensational, of course, and a great many remain unresolved because of a lack of police resources. This is where 19-year-old Eric Schubert of Medford, New Jersey, is lending a hand. Schubert is an expert in genealogy, his interest beginning when he was just a small child, and he now has his own genealogy business, primarily focused on helping people to research family trees and adoption issues. So we thought we'd ask Eric about his fascinating occupation, and he joins us now on the Roundup. Hi, Eric.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, we're glad to have you with us. To start, tell us how you became involved with genealogy.
Yeah, it's an interesting story, and it's kind of two-pronged. So I'm 19 now, and I got into genealogy probably when I was around 9, 10 years old. The first part was I was often homesick when I was a kid. I used to get pneumonia all the time. So I would be home annoying my mother, you know, the typical standard 9-year-old thing to do. Mm-hmm. And she saw an Ancestry.com commercial. And she said, you know what, Eric, why don't you try that? And maybe it'll use up some of your time, keep you busy. So I did, and I just thought it would be a quick little thing, but here I am 10 years later. And the second part why I was so interested in it at that time was because around that time, I actually lost all of my three living grandparents in the span of a year. So it just really got me, looking to and looking forward about my history and, you know, my grandparents and their families. So those two things kind of put together have been what started me and what's kept me going.
So why is this so interesting to you?
There's so many facets to it, and I wake up every day and I have no idea what I'm going to get into. I could be helping a police department solve a murder. I could be helping someone find a picture of a grandfather that they've never met. Hmm. I could be helping someone find their biological parents' names in 20 minutes that they've been looking for 60 years. So I just never know what I'm going to look into. And that's why I think genealogy is so fascinating, because I really see it as a tool that can help people and change lives.
Well, again, you've been at this for a while and you've built a thriving business. And we'll talk about, you know, family tree issues and adoption and et cetera in just a little bit. But first, let's get to your police work. Describe what goes into the process of investigative genetic genealogy.
Yes, it's such an interesting process, and I think it's really important that the public be informed about it, just because it really is revolutionary at this point in time. So basically what happens is police take DNA evidence, whether that be blood or anything else, and they send it to a lab for DNA sequencing. So once that is done, and it's always done at a private lab, I haven't heard of state labs doing, you know, genetic genealogy, DNA sequencing. But after that sequencing is done, it's usually uploaded as a profile, a genetic profile, to a open source free genealogy site called GenMatch, which is public, but people upload their DNA data there. So a common misconception is that police can use common DNA sites like Ancestry and 23andMe to do this, and that's not true.
Okay.
So that DNA profile is uploaded usually into this site called GenMatch. And from there, a set of genetic matches is formed. And that is like any other DNA test. And from there, people like me come in to use those genetic matches and piece together family trees to find common descendants and find people who might be good suspects. You know, you might have a third, fourth cousin matches if you can identify a specific family from the 1800s. You can trace it down. You can come up with a list of, let's say, 10 suspects who are in that area, who are descendants, who match these genetic matches. And from there, it's just good old-fashioned police work, you know, seeing who might be a good suspect, who has a record. So in reality, it's basically like the suspect is taking a DNA test like Ancestry, but it's just being put into a more public database like GenMatch instead of a more private and larger one like Ancestry.com.
So what sorts of cases have you worked on?
I have worked on basically every sort of case that you can with this sort of technology, just because, of course, you need evidence. So you can't really work on certain types of cases that way, you know, when you need DNA evidence. But I've worked on and am working on murder, sexual assaults. So really anything. Jane and John Doe's is another area where this comes, you know, very much in handy.
Yeah.
So as long as there's genetic evidence from, you know, the killer, the attacker, this can be done. So it doesn't apply to some cases, but it does apply to a vast majority.
Those are some heavy issues. How do you handle that?
Yes. Yeah, well, I've always said that genealogy, you know, as a genealogist, I'm part therapist, part investigator, part genealogist. I always just take it seriously. Of course, when you're working with law enforcement, when I consult with them, you, of course, are trying to be very serious about it, laying out the evidence, laying out the genetics, trying to just have the law enforcement officers know specifically where things are at and where my head is at, where, you know, while I'm searching. So it's just about, you know, being professional, taking it seriously. You know, it's important work, even if some of these cases are 40, 50, 60 years old. There are families and people out there who are still looking for answers.
Sure.
So I just give it my all and hope for the best.
And when a criminal case has been solved and you know you've played a part in its resolution, you know, what goes through your mind?
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. And I've thought about it a lot, just because for the past few years, I've been helping adoptees, people find their family trees. So, of course, you know, giving someone their biological parents' names, that's a huge thing, and I love doing that. But being able to know that you are, you know, you were the catalyst for solving a 25-year-old cold case at, you know, 18, 19 years old, it's just so unique for me, and it's a different way of helping people that I'm very passionate and really excited about
doing. Are you finding a lot of need from local police departments or even police departments elsewhere in the country?
Yes, just because I actually got into this about a year ago. I was contacted by a police department in Montgomery County, and this was always something that I had wanted to do, but of course I didn't want to step on any toes. I was 18 years old, you know, didn't want to overstep my boundaries. So once I was contacted to consult and get into solving cases, I was really excited about it. So I solved this one case, and then right around the pandemic, I found myself wanting more. So I was home bored from school, so I thought, you know what? I wonder if there's any interest nationally for someone like myself to just look at these cases, you know, on a volunteer basis, just to use up my time and keep myself busy. And I found out that there's such a need for just someone to look over these cases, because sometimes genetic genealogy work is done, but funding runs out, you know, hearts aren't in it. So it just sits there. So someone like me can come in if it's been sitting there for 2 years, and if I'm not stepping on anyone's toes or overstepping, I can, you know, offer to take a look at it and check it out just because I enjoy being busy. I find it very interesting. It's a puzzle you have to put together. So there's been quite a need. I have about a half a dozen cases on my plate right now, but it's just really interesting for me to do.
And at the same time, you're doing adoption research. Let's get to that for a little bit. Is every client of yours necessarily interested in meeting the relatives you found?
That's an interesting question, because everyone is always different, I think is a good way to put it. I never know what a specific, you know, person who is adopted might be looking for or might want to do. So what I like to do is just present all the information. I'll say, okay, here are your parents. This is when they were born. This is when they died. Here are the addresses and phone numbers of half siblings. If you want to reach out, if you need some letter templates or guidance in reaching out, I'll be happy to help, but otherwise, you know, just let me know any questions, because some people are very eager, but on the other hand, some people are not very eager.
Yeah.
I had a case where I was asked to look into it. I found who someone's parents were, and she was shocked that I did, and she didn't want to know their names.
Okay. Well, you know, that's fair.
Exactly.
What do you normally find in these cases? Quite often surprised in the results that you come up with?
Yes, just because it's so interesting to work these cases, because of course they're very sensitive and everything like that. But when you're looking into it, it can be interesting to see, you know, some tricks that people might have played around that time. You know, if I'm working on an adoption case and I find out who the parents are and the birth certificate is, you know, the mother's maiden name, and they switched the names around and they were, you know, trying to be secretive about it. So that part can be interesting, just seeing what the genetics say versus what is said on paper. And I really, like I've been saying, I really never know what I'm going to come up with. I can have, you know, very heavy adoption cases where I have to tell someone, you know, I had my first adoption case was actually I had to tell a woman that her biological parents were killed in a murder-suicide.
Oh, gosh.
So that's pretty heavy. But on the other hand, it can be really light. I had a client who has been looking for years. I helped her out in about a day. Her and her biological father have a great relationship. She actually just wrote a whole book on the situation. So it's just, it can be really nice, but on the other hand, it can, of course, be tough.
Do you get cases in which people want to know if they're related to, say, Ruth Bader Ginsburg or perhaps a famous actor?
For sure, all the time. And usually it's pretty interesting, because as much as I want to prove it and my goal is to prove it and, you know, help this person understand more about their family history, oftentimes, 99 times out of 100, whatever the relation that's claimed is not true, just because a lot of these are family stories.
Yeah.
And sometimes family stories aren't 100% accurate. A lot of times there's an element of truth to them, but usually it's something along the line of, okay, my mother's maiden name is Ginsburg, so I must be related to Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Yeah. What's it like knowing that you're, in effect, peering back through the decades and centuries?
It's so fun. I really enjoy it, and it really keeps me busy, and it really, you know, keeps me grounded, I think is a good way to put it. I've always loved history since I was a kid. Since I was a kid, I actually used to be able to repeat, you know, the 44 presidents at that time, forwards and backwards. Can't do that now. Have no idea how that started, but I just loved history. So genealogy, I think, has been a really fun way and a really powerful way to know my family history and just know more about history in general.
Tell us about modern techniques in which you can access records, birth records, death records, et cetera, that go back, I don't know how far, decades, even centuries?
Yeah, it's so interesting because it always varies, but usually there's always so many interesting records to be found. So many records are digitized online if you know where to look for them on genealogy sites and free sites. Census records, birth records, marriage records, death records, like you said, these are records that I can find from the 1800s, 1700s even. I have a lot of family from New England, and I have birth registers from 1756 in New England.
Wow.
So it's just amazing what has been digitized and is available for public viewing. Well, a lot of them are free online, but there are some paid services.
What sorts of challenges might you come up against? For instance, you know, a century ago, many immigrants changed their names when they got here, or even with African-American history, in which records might not be as complete as you like.
Exactly. It can be tough. And like I've been saying, genealogy is fun because I just never know what I'm going to run into. But a lot of records can be not helpful. For example, my dad's grandmother, she was born in 1922. And I cannot find her in any census record, which, you know, if you're in America in 1930 and 1940, you should be in a census record. So people can fall through the cracks in records. Names were changed, like you mentioned. My last name, Schubert, was actually Zagrogowski. So talk about someone spelling that out on a record. You know, these things can be lost to time. They can be cataloged wrong with the surnames. So people can slip through the cracks, and that is a problem in genealogy, yes.
What is your absolute favorite case to have worked on?
I think I'm not necessarily sure I have a favorite case in general or in total, but I think in general my favorite type of cases to work on are positive adoption cases. Because as much as, like I mentioned earlier, I have adoption cases where, you know, it's pretty heavy, I have a ton of adoption cases where I get texts and emails and calls from people months down the line telling me that they went to the art museum with their brother the other day, or they're going down to Florida to visit their mother. So just getting those updates and just knowing as a whole that when I was, you know, 16, 17, 18, 19 years old, I was helping people do that. I really think it's indescribable. And it's humbling, and it's just really nice to know about.
Well, you are a unique teenager. What do your family and friends think?
Thank you. Yeah, I actually have my friends have coined me the world's oldest teenager, so that's fun. I get it. So my family, of course, is very supportive, which I'm very appreciative of. I love sharing my finds with my direct family and some of my extended family. So it's just really fun to go back in time, like we were talking about earlier, and help my parents and my family understand family stories that they might have heard, show them cool records. And my friends think it's pretty interesting, too. I've always helped them with their family histories. It's like my party trick. So it's just something really fun that I think a lot of people can relate to, and a lot of people find it really interesting.
You are in college. Is this a passion you are going to pursue, for a vocation, a business down the road?
I'm not necessarily sure I see myself doing genealogy as a dedicated profession, but it's certainly something that I will never let go. Here I am 10 years strong. I haven't let go. So I think it's something that regardless of what I'll be doing at any given time, it's something that I'll continue to do throughout my life, you know, on the side or just in general, because it's so unique and I just love helping people.
Well, Eric Schubert, great to have you with us, and good luck on your cases.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Well, Eric Schubert has formed ES Genealogy. And again, we appreciate having you on with us. This reminder to our listeners, you can find the Regional Roundup on social media at whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producer is John Ahrens, and I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks for tuning in. Be well.